The BBC presents The Good Giant, a portrait by many hands of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
What would you say was the most famous encounter in literary history? Boswell meeting Johnson, perhaps? Or Henry Morton Stanley in the year 1871 in the depths of the African jungle?
Dr. Livingstone, I presume?
Or was it the day, some 10 or so years later, when a young fellow named Stamford, otherwise totally undistinguished, took a certain ex-army doctor to a London hospital laboratory to meet the man with whom he might share rooms?
Dr. Watson, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Thus began that great partnership. So there appeared for the first time undoubtedly the most famous character not only in British literature but in world literature. The spare time creation of a 27-year-old medical man of No. 1 Bush Villas, Elm Grove, Southsea. Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle. This program is about Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Arthur as he became in the year 1902. Yet, as he wrote himself in a letter to his mother,
"The title I really value most, ma'am, is that of doctor, which was conferred by your self-sacrifice and determination."
He always did refer to his mother as the ma'am, incidentally. And so to a consideration of the first great influence in the life of this man, who was once called by a French journalist the good giant, and to some facts, as it were, from a detached history or encyclopedia.
Arthur Conan Doyle was born on the 22nd of May, 1859, at Piccadilly Place, Edinburgh. His father, Charles Altman Doyle, brother to Dickie Doyle, the famous Punch cartoonist, was an artist and architect employed at Her Majesty's Office of Works at just over 200 a year. His mother had been born Mary Foley, of an exiled Irish family, as indeed his father was too. Arthur was sent to be educated at the Jesuit College of Stonyhurst in Lancashire, where his favorite reading was Macaulay and the Romance of Ivanhoe by that distant kinsman of his, and where he grew mightily.
"Dear Mom, at Christmas, three of my friends and I had two turkeys, one very large goose, two chickens, one large ham, two large sausages, seven boxes of sardines, one of lobster, a plate full of tarts, and seven pots of jam. It is difficult to write a description of oneself, but I believe I am now 5 feet 9 inches high, pretty stout, clad in dark garments, and above all with a flaring red muffler round my neck. I've also learned to play in the military band the largest brass horn ever seen, which winds round me twice, and blowing it is splendid work for the chest."
That last was in Germany, where he went to complete his young education in 1875. Then back to Edinburgh and into the university to study medicine. He won a bursary to the place, but through an administrative mistake, he never got the scholarship money, and the strain on his parents was immense. But during his years of study, he went out in leisure and vacation times as a medical assistant or dispenser, so helping to earn his keep at least. He worked in this part-time way in Shropshire, in Birmingham, as a ship's surgeon on the whaler Hope out of Peterhead, 7 months in the Arctic at a pay of £50, until in 1881 he took his medical degree at last. Then another voyage as a ship's surgeon along the fever-swept west coast of Africa, a spell as an assistant with a rather curious old fellow student of his at Plymouth, and finally the day when he put up his own nameplate outside the little villa house in Southsea near Portsmouth.
That will fetch them. Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle. And a red lamp up there and all. Now all I need is some furniture. And a page boy. It would be grand to have a page boy in buttons to add a bit of tone when the patients arrive.
He was a man of action, the young doctor, for all his size, 6'2" in height by this time, and a solid 15 stone in flesh and muscle. And so he did find a page boy. His younger brother, Innes, who has left this memorable description of a typical day in their life.
"This morning after breakfast, Arthur went downstairs and began to write a story about a man with three eyes. Well, I was upstairs inventing a new waterworks that will send rockets over the moon in 2 minutes, and they will send small shot at the same distance. Then it was 1:15, so I had to go and put on the last potatoes, the only 6 we had in the world. But then a patient came to the door, and I took one look at her and was able to shout out, "Arthur, hooray! It's another baby!"
Now, that extract from Innes Doyle's childhood diary bears consideration, I think. Note the phrase, "Arthur went downstairs and began to write a story." Or plainly, something had to be done to eke out the meager earnings of that bleakly furnished little establishment. And a letter that arrived one day in 1883 seemed to suggest a way out.
Messrs. Smith, Elder and Company present their compliments to A.C. Doyle, Esquire, and have pleasure in enclosing a check for 29 guineas in payment for Mr. Doyle's contribution to the Cornhill Magazine, the story entitled J. Habakkuk Jephson's Statement.
It was one of the first of many tales that the doctor wrote. And the need to write still more increased when he married the sister of one of his patients, Louise Hawkins, known as Tui. Among them was a novel, later published as The Firm of Girdlestone. And among them, too, was a story to which he gave the first title of A Tangled Skein, and which was to be about...
A detective. Yes, a detective, I think. But something different from Poe or Gaborio. The detection of crime as an exact science, perhaps. The study of clues. Someone able to deduce all kinds of facts from a few simple observations. The way old Joe Bell used to do to amuse us all at Edinburgh University. Yes. And with an unusual name. Say, Sherrinford Helm. Or Holmes. No, not quite right, not quite. Might use the old Irish name, Sherlock, perhaps. And the story told by some friend of his, a name like Ormond Sacker, or Osmond Sacker. Now, that's too fanciful. He ought to be simpler, a name like James Watson, or John's. John H. Watson. And A Tangled Skein isn't quite right for a title. Something more descriptive and dramatic. Say, A Study in Scarlet. Yes, and definitely Sherlock. Sherlock Holmes.
Well, thus, very briefly, the early facts, the first phase. A Study in Scarlet was rejected by publisher after publisher. And when it finally was accepted, it was at an overall copyright fee of £25. But the day was to come when Holmes could earn 10 shillings a word for his unwilling creator. The original Sherlock, of course, is said to have been that famous old tutor of Conan Doyle's, Dr. Joseph Bell, who would entertain his classes with deductive descriptions of the patients who came before him. As a matter of fact, as Dr. Douglas Guthrie, former lecturer in the history of medicine at Edinburgh University, remembers today.
He was a very well-known Edinburgh surgeon who came of a long line of surgeons. I can remember seeing Joe Bell in his Victoria, as the carriage and pair of that day was called, driving in the west end of Edinburgh. That must have been several years before his death, which occurred in 1911. Joseph Bell, in teaching, was never tired of impressing upon his students the importance of trifles. There is nothing so important as trifles. You know my method. It is founded upon the observation of trifles. Never trust to general impressions, but always concentrate upon details. Those are sayings of Sherlock Holmes, but originally and in real life, they are the words of Joseph Bell.
The real trouble, of course, in any assessment of Conan Doyle, particularly in such a brief one as this, is to cover the ground. The man's range was immense. Even in those early South Sea days, while he worked at his first historical novel, Micah Clarke, and still carried on with the practice, he was also an ardent athlete, one of the safest association football backs in Hampshire, according to the local paper. And he had become vice president of the Liberal Unionists, secretary of the Literary and Scientific Society, and captain of the Portsmouth Cricket Club. Then,
the early 90s, and a decision to move to London and take up authorship as a full-time profession. Mr. Sherlock Holmes in a series of short stories in the newly formed Strand magazine. The old romance of heraldry lessons with his mother, finding expression in The White Company, that book of ancient chivalry and adventure that he'd loved the best himself of all his works. Collaboration with J.M. Barrie in the libretto of an operetta, which failed miserably. A play for his old boyhood hero, Henry Irving, which succeeded gloriously. Mounting fame, but personal tragedy too in those years. The death of his father, and the terrible news that his wife was a desperately sick woman from tuberculosis.
I am afraid, dear ma'am, that we must reconcile ourselves to the diagnosis. Tui and I must leave as soon as possible for St. Moritz or Davos, where the climate would give her a chance. Meanwhile, ma'am, I have carried out my old threat, which you have begged me for so long to resist. No matter what the Strand may say, I am in the middle of the last home story, involving a struggle on the verge of the falls of Reichenbach, after which the gentleman vanishes, never to return. I am weary of his name. He keeps me from better things.
The Strand said a great deal, as did the whole Western world. But there was compensation. The endlessly driving pen still covered the pages, and it was in Switzerland that there was born the second of his great popular characters.
Colonel Etienne Gerard, I've always heard that you are a very gallant and enterprising officer.
Mon général, it would be folly for me to deny it.
You are also an excellent rider.
Mon général, I admit it.
And the best swordsman in the 6th Brigades of Light Cavalry.
You are famous, mon général, for the accuracy of your information. The Emperor has said himself, as you doubtless remember, that he thought I had the stoutest heart of all in his army.
Brigadier Gerard, the eternal, lovable bombast of the Grand Armée. A far cry from the vanished Sherlock. And a far cry, too, from the third of the great ones, still unborn.
Allosaurus! Megalosaurus! The most terrible types of animal life that have ever cursed the earth or blessed a museum, Malone. And there, in the swamps beyond, are the pterodactyls. Thousands upon thousands of still surviving pterodactyls. Iguanodons, the very saber-toothed tiger himself. Maple White was right. A whole lost world. Magnificent! Magnificent! The lost world!
The unconquerable Professor Challenger. Challenger of the ape-like frame and the huge, out-jutting black beard. Leader of one of the most celebrated expeditions in all literature. Indeed, as I've said, as the creative years went on, the range was immense. From Yellow Fog Baker Street to the campaigns of Napoleon. From irate scientists among the Brontosauri to the medieval bowmen of England. This, after all the years, is perhaps the moment for a brief consideration by a distinguished present-day literary critic of Conan Doyle's work, Professor David Duckies.
Most detectives are simply clever men who do their stuff and solve their problems. Sherlock Holmes, set in that clearly rendered late 19th century London, painted so vividly, so idiosyncratic, so memorable because of his peculiarities, so right, so able, solving things by the mind, sitting there in his rooms and waiting for life to come to him. The point about Dr. Watson, I think, in these stories, is that he represents us, the reader. His reactions are exactly ours. He's not stupid, except in relation to Sherlock Holmes. He draws all the obvious conclusions, and the reader is absolutely fascinated by finding himself in the person of Dr. Watson, being shown up, as it were, being made to surrender to a superior intellect. I began by saying that he really belongs to folklore, and what I mean is that he has entered into the imagination of people. His magnifying glass, his deerstalker cap and all the rest of it, his curved pipe. He is a figure like, like Robin Hood or some character who isn't strictly remembered because of the degree to which people actually read and appreciate literary works. but who have taken on a life of their own outside literature.
Well, whatever the final judgment, even of a future further from him than ours, his own purpose was always clear.
The first object of a novelist is to tell a tale. If he has no story to tell, what is he there for? Possibly he has something to say which is worth saying, but he should say it in another form.
What do you mean by it? Why, your very height and breadth would make you a sure and simple target. You must listen to me as your mother. Do not go to South Africa, Arthur. If these politicians and journalists who so lightly drift into war are to go to the front themselves, they would be a great deal more careful.
But Conan Doyle did go to the Boer War. He was by now, at the turn of the century and in his middle age, one of the most popular authors of his time. But the old stirring grew within him, too. And if the War Office said that he was too old for a tobby, he suddenly remembered that he was a doctor, as well as an author who might indeed have something to say in another form than that of a novel. It was for his services in the Boer War that Conan Doyle was knighted. Although he was unwilling himself to accept the honor, he felt that he had done only his simple duty. But there were his months of personal devotion in the nightmare enteric hospitals, his constant strivings in endless pamphlets and articles to set out the rights and wrongs of that confused conflict, with the proceeds going to charity. Then, finally, his massive history of the war, as he was to write one later, too, of the Great War. Oh, yes, the range was immense. And in a thousand other unexpected ways, too. He had a mind, in a phrase of H.G. Wells, of unappeasable freshness. He stood twice for Parliament in Scottish divisions and was defeated both times. Perhaps fortunately, for he often said himself that he was no real politician. He took wrestling lessons from the great Sandow and was invited as a boxing expert to referee the controversial Johnson-Jeffries prize fight in America. In the house that he built for his family, there was a special rifle range, to say nothing of an experimental gyroscopic railway driven by electricity, in which his two children whizzed delightedly through the grounds. And he was an ecstatic pioneer motorist and motorcyclist, an immense figure hurtling along the quiet country roads, and later taking part in one of the first trans-European car races. And inevitably, in the midst of it all, almost 10 years after Holmes' disappearance at Reichenbach, the secret was out. Holmes had never fallen over the precipice at all.
Holmes! Is it really you? Forgive me if I fainted at the sight of you just now, but I can still hardly believe my eyes. Good heaven! To think that you of all men, should be standing in my study.
My dear Watson, I owe you 1,000 apologies. I had no idea that my reappearance would so affect you. Oh, yes, I'm alive, alive and well. And once more on the trail, Watson. With you, I hope, beside me.
To the end, Holmes.
Come then, the trail.
And a more popular trail than ever, even to this day. The stories have been translated into almost every known language. They've been issued in Arabic as police textbooks. In Russia, at this moment, the Red Army learned their logical deduction from the translated adventures of Holmes. And all over the world, there are scores of enthusiastic Holmes societies to argue the exact whereabouts of 221B Baker Street and the precise color of Mrs. Watson's hair. Holmes has been portrayed in every medium, in the theater, on films, silent, talking, and technicolored, on radio and television, even on long-playing recordings. His appeal is universal.
equal to a scholar and a schoolboy. And it's just possible that one of the reasons, at least, is that Sherlock Holmes was real. He had another great prototype, even besides Dr. Joseph Bell. History again.
1906. The sudden release from prison with no explanation of a young Birmingham solicitor, George Dalgey, a half-caste Indian. He'd been sent there 3 years before for a series of mysterious crimes involving scurrilous anonymous letters and the senseless slaughter in the night of cattle and ponies. But there was strong feeling in the country that Dalgey had been wrongly convicted, and a champion took up his case, arranging to meet him in the foyer of a London hotel.
You're Mr. Dalgey, I believe.
Yes.
I'm Conan Doyle. Don't you suffer from astigmatic myopia?
I beg your pardon?
I noticed you holding your paper sideways to your eyes as I came over. And I once studied to be an eye surgeon. Wasn't this eye trouble of yours raised at your trial?
No, Sir Arthur. I wanted it used, but my legal advisors felt that there was no point.
There's all the point in the world. The thing's elementary. No man with eyesight like yours could scour the country at night time to commit these terrible crimes, as you're said to have done. And now about these anonymous letters that you're supposed to have written.
He devoted many months to the Dalgey case, not only proving brilliantly in a series of newspaper articles that Dalgey was innocent, but pointing the way towards the real culprit. And later, too, in the same vein, there was the case of Oscar Slater in Glasgow that Conan Doyle investigated in the name of justice, and won after a fight lasting more than 16 years. This is the voice of John Dixon Carr from his home in America, and not only in his own right one of the most notable of all present-day detective story writers, but also Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's official biographer.
Who was Sherlock Holmes? It's my belief, I have said it often enough, that Sherlock Holmes was none other than Conan Doyle himself. It's true he hated the man. As we all know, he tried to kill Sherlock Holmes. And yet, under that guise, under all the workings of his mind, he could not help but feel that Sherlock Holmes was himself. Thus, when he brings him into the stories, he masquerades Sherlock Holmes when Sherlock Holmes is posing as a German spy during the First World War under the name of Altamont, which was Conan Doyle's father's name. When he makes Sherlock Holmes refuse a knighthood in 1902 in one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, that is the same year in which Conan Doyle himself wished to refuse a knighthood, but was persuaded by his mother that it would be better if he accepted the offer. All through the warp and woof of those stories which have so caught the imagination of the world, in every language and in every land, we see always the workings of a man who says to himself, what is the fascination of this Holmes puppet?
The remaining facts of the life itself must be covered only briefly.
His second marriage to an old friend, Jean Leckie. More books, Sir Nigel and the Challenger saga. More lecture tours in America and Canada. His work already mentioned in The Great War, and his six-volume history of it, with the royalties devoted to the cause of ex-servicemen. The deaths through the war of his brother Innes and his eldest son Kingsley. The death of the Marm in 1921 at 83.
And finally, through the last 10 years of his life, his tireless devotion to the cause of spiritualism. It had interested him for many years. It was no sudden new enthusiasm. He wrote on the subject endlessly and had to pay for the publication of these later works. He lectured all over the world to gigantic crowds in Australia, America, South Africa, Scandinavia. And whatever our own views may be, there's no denying the energy and sincerity of his.
From the moment that I had understood the overwhelming importance of this subject and realized how utterly it must change and chasten the whole thought of the world when it is wholeheartedly accepted, I felt that all other work which I had ever done or ever could do was as nothing compared to this.
In the end, it was probably the ceaseless expenditure of himself on the cause that killed him. He would not rest until they laid him to rest in the July of 1930. And on the oaken headstone above him, in the grounds of Windlesham in Sussex, his last home, there are inscribed only his name, the date of his birth, and the quotation,
"Steel true, blade straight."
Well, the facts
some few of them. Here, towards the end, is a closer and more personal reminiscence of the man behind the facts, the man that simple headstone commemorates. Conan Doyle had 5 children, 2 by his first marriage, 3 by his second. The youngest of the sons, Adrian, had this to say when we asked him about his father at his home in Switzerland.
No, officially, of course, his championship of spiritualism cost him his peerage. There's no argument about that. It didn't worry my father. But it would have been pleasant if he had been recipient of that national gesture. He certainly deserved it. It says very little for authority that they interfered.
And when he was asked about the very keynote of his father's personality...
Oh, I think his great sense of humanity, more than anything else. Mark, you've asked me a very difficult question, because in dealing with him, we're really dealing with the characters of 6 men rolled into one. But I should say that it was his great sense of humanity and justice. Throughout his whole life, in his contact with his fellow men, and in the fact that he was never appealed to in vain, however much it would have cost him in work, out of his own pocket or anything else, if anybody was in trouble or a victim of injustice, they had only to come to my father, and once he'd satisfied himself that it was a genuine case, he would bring all his great powers and his great resources to bear on putting that injustice right. And that, of course, was his motive right the way through his life. In every sense of the word.
At the last, there is one even closer link. The one single recording in existence of the man himself. An interview in an early newsreel film made only a few months before he died.
There are 2 things that people always want to ask me. Well, one of them is how I ever came to write the Sherlock Holmes stories. And the other is about how I came to have psychic experiences and to take so much interest in that question. Well, first of all, about the Sherlock Holmes stories, it came about in this way. I was quite a young doctor at the time. I'd had, of course, a scientific training, and I used occasionally to read detective stories. It always annoyed me how in the old-fashioned detective story, the detective always seemed to get at his results either by some sort of lucky chance or a fluke, or else it was quite unexplained how he got there. He got there, but he never gave an explanation how. People ask me, will I write any more Sherlock Holmes stories? I certainly don't think it's at all probable. As I grow older, the psychic subject always grows in intensity, and then one becomes more earnest upon it. And I should think that my few remaining years will probably be devoted much more in that direction than in the direction of literature.
This program has been no more than a sketch of 1 or 2 aspects of a very full and adventurous life. It has also been an unashamed tribute. There were probably other sides. There must have been, as in all men. But on this occasion, it is best to remember the good giant as someone who gave pleasure and still gives pleasure to many millions. A great creator. The bearer of what Robert Louis Stevenson called the white plume of Conan Doyle. The panache. The Good Giant, a portrait of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, was compiled by John Keir Cross. The narrator was Leonard McGuire, and the part of Conan Doyle was spoken by Tom Fleming. Production in the Scottish studios of the BBC